Welcome to Purple Politics Nevada. I'm your host, Lucia Starbuck. The name refers to the fact that the state isn't red or blue, it's both. Can you believe we are in season 3 of the show? The 120-day biennial session kicks off on February 3rd. The Democratic-controlled legislature will again need to work with Republican Governor Joe Lombardo. In 2023, he set a record with the number of bills he vetoed. He's up for re-election next year, and he outlined some of his goals during the State of the State earlier this week.
We know too many Nevadans are seriously questioning if they'll ever have the chance to own a home. The root cause of our crisis is Nevada families and builders are being held back by the federal government's reluctance to release the land we need for housing. We bear an important responsibility to protect the natural splendor of Nevada while solving our housing crisis. That means supporting what works and shedding outdated practices that slow progress or drive up costs. By streamlining permits, prioritizing the use of every buildable acre of land for Nevadans, not out-of-state investors looking to cash in.
So I sat down with state lawmakers and leadership and one freshman to better understand their vision for improving the lives of everyday Nevadans. We talked about some of the major topics: education, healthcare, housing, and the environment. Last year, Nevada received an F from a national report on state legislative support for public education due to lax charter school laws, gaps between high poverty and low poverty districts, funding, and teacher salaries. First, I'm joined by Democratic Senate Majority Leader Nicole Cannizzaro to talk about how the legislature is supporting schools. Thank you so much for joining me, Senator Cannizzaro.
Thank you for having me.
The legislative session is right around the corner, but you've already outlined some of your education goals with a $500 million bill called the Educate Act. I know it hasn't been formally drafted yet, but what can parents, students, and teachers expect?
So what we're trying to accomplish is really creating mechanisms to make sure that the school districts are being held accountable. When we're using public tax dollars in our education system, that we have transparency in that. And ultimately, that we're delivering for families and for students and for teachers and the staff. It is something that we hear from families throughout Nevada all the time, that education is a priority, and it is something that we as legislators ultimately have the ability to affect real change with. And so what we put together through a series of meetings and sit-downs and interviews with people who have been involved in all different aspects of the education space is where we kind of came up with 5 big goals that we are trying to accomplish. So those are making sure that we have a qualified teacher in every classroom, we have great staff in every school, making sure that we're improving student outcomes, that we're giving kids a great head start. We're having accountability for public schools and public dollars.
You mentioned giving kids an early head start. Mm-hmm. A big piece of that bill is universal pre-K. Why is that necessary?
We know that it contributes highly to increased literacy levels, that it helps with math and science, that it helps generally with students just being prepared to enter into formal schooling. And so pre-K is a huge cornerstone of how it is that you set kids up for success. Here in Nevada, we have historically had pretty low pre-K participation rates, and most of the kids who are accessing pre-K fall into one of two categories. Either parents who can afford to send their kids to a pre-kindergarten program, or kids who fall within a very narrow definition under the state for access to free pre-K. But not having that access is a huge barrier for so many families in being able to get their kids into a pre-kindergarten program. There is obviously a huge cost that's going to come with that. And we're also looking at how it is that we are going to build up the infrastructure to allow that access for all four-year-olds.
Another piece of the bill is to continue the matching fund for teacher raises. Will you explain how that will work and how it's worked from the last session 2 years ago?
In 2023, we passed Senate Bill 231, which was basically a bill that set up a pot of money. It was $250 million that would allow for school districts to come before the legislature's interim finance committee, showing that they were giving raises to teachers and to staff, and then the state would match those raises. So it's sort of an additional amount of money that can be utilized by school districts over and above what they are getting from the per pupil funding plan and any of their local revenues, which is what they are currently funded by. And so this allowed for districts to really think about how they could utilize the money that they had in their budget to give raises to teachers and to staff. And the challenges are different and unique depending on which school district you're talking about. And so during the interim, we were able to listen to almost all of the school districts with plans for how it is they were going to pay teachers and staff. With that, we were able to see that between the money that the school districts were putting forward and also the Senate Bill 231 funds, that school districts across the state gave significant raises to both teachers and staff, and most of them very close to approaching 20%. That's a huge piece for how it is that we recruit and retain educators. Some of the things that we have heard from school districts who've utilized this money is that this money is helping. They have made appreciable differences in the number of vacancies that they've either seen because fewer teachers and staff are electing to retire or retire early. And we're also hearing that there are districts across the state that are filling these vacancies because we have more competitive pay and salary. And so the Educate Act is also seeking to develop statewide programs, including investing in pathways for paraprofessionals and for alternative routes to licensure.
You mentioned there were some barriers and challenges. I'm curious, were these raises equal all across the board, or were there some school districts who couldn't quite meet that 20% raise? And is there anything the legislature can do to give a little extra support to those school districts?
Yeah, it wasn't 20% in every single school district. It depends because some school districts are also starting at different pay, or they have different needs for some of the types of teachers that they needed to go and recruit. So we wanted to be able to give that flexibility because a rural school district does not operate the same way as some of our urban school districts. Larger school districts might have different challenges. The whole purpose of SB 231 was to say, listen, we want to be able to match you with state money where you are able to give raises. So talk to us a little bit about what that looks like. We didn't put specific, you must pay a certain percentage and you have to do it for these specific teachers. Most districts saw very significant increases. I think Clark County ended up at 19.2 and Washoe was at 20. Some of our other districts are at 17, 14. We're of course open to, and the legislative process is always open to, additional ideas on how we can do things better to make sure that we're continuing to invest in public education, and that's sort of the overarching goal.
Another area where Nevada lags behind other states is healthcare. There are persistent workforce shortages in medicine, nursing, mental health, public health, and so many others. That's even more so in rural Nevada, where patients will travel more than an hour to give birth, care for a broken arm, or really any kind of specialty care. Someone who knows what that's like is Republican Senate Minority Leader Robin Titus, who represents a large swath of rural Nevada. Thank you so much for joining me, Senator Titus.
So thank you first for inviting me. It's an honor to be here.
Let's talk about something you're very familiar with, rural health care. You've been a family medicine physician in rural Nevada. What are some of the barriers to rural health care, and how can you address those issues this session?
The reason I ran for office from the very beginning was because of health care. Lyon County paid my way through medical school, so I would go back and practice there. I owed them 3 years, and I've been there 40 years now. So after residency, I went back, had a private practice, and then health care is a tough business to be in, and solo practice. And so then I went to work for the hospital, rural hospital district, and then became the county health officer. I also left day-to-day practice a couple years ago when I became the minority leader in the assembly. But I really got interested in running for office when it was during the Affordable Care Act debate. They were having policy decisions about health care by people who write policy, but they were never in the trenches trying to get health care for a patient. You'd spend hours trying to get prior authorization and trying to get solutions to that for people going back to the rural areas. People don't want to live in the rural areas, especially young folks. They want to come up in more of a lifestyle, Northern Nevada, very active for young families, and trying to get them to move out to my rural areas. I mean, I literally, for my career, was the only healthcare provider, only doctor in 30 miles in any direction. I had a little helicopter pad. My home, the same one I live in now, 40 years later, was my office for a decade. So how do we fix that? How do we get people interested? Somebody like me, I say, grow your own. You have to grow your own. So you have to get invested in the community, in the school. So I'm very engaged in the education process. I'm trying to get kids interested in healthcare from the very start, in the elementary school. The other thing we're doing is having reciprocity. Some of the bills that I've brought through, and reciprocity just means if you're licensed in one state and you have no issues and you're in good standing in your state, you should be able to move to Nevada and not wait 6 months to get your license. Reimbursement-free education. As I mentioned, my county paid my way through medical school. The good thing was they paid my way during it, so I didn't have to incur this incredible debt. So a lot of young doctors saying, well, I can't afford to go out there because I have $100,000 or $200,000 or $250,000, whatever it costs today. I can't afford to go there. I have to go someplace where I'm going to make a better income. And then now one of the things we've expanded this loan reimbursement, so not just for physicians, but we've expanded it to nurse practitioners and lab techs. That's the other thing. It's not just providers that is lacking in rural areas, but it's across the spectrum of healthcare, from a lab technician, x-ray technicians, all those kind of folks. We can't get them out there either.
Have you already started working on some bills to address some of these things?
Right. I have a reciprocity bill. It's called occupational license reform. A bill that I'm putting forward is some unique way to help pay for graduate medical education. And then a bill I sat on the interim healthcare committee, and a committee bill that really I'm sponsoring is to support, do a social worker internship program so that they can get paid. We did that with the nursing programs during COVID years where we were desperate for nurses. Folks came up with this idea to help get student nursing, to come out to rural areas and do the rural rotations out there and some of the rotations in the hospitals and get paid for that because it's expensive to drive out there. And so it was such a success, we had to put more money into it.
And looking at bills from last session, you had one that passed that required Medicaid to cover outpatient beds for critical access hospitals.
Right.
Tell me more about that and how's that going?
Very well. It will be the difference to keeping some of these rural hospitals open. One of the things that I think people don't understand is that the actual cost of doing business, the cost of keeping your lights on in healthcare, in my office, it was about, let's say, $105 for me to see a patient in 15 minutes. When you look at my liability costs, keeping the lights on in the building, maintenance people, my personnel, my nursing staff, all of those things. Heaven forbid I also get paid. And they pay us $60. And so I would say to the patients, listen, it costs me money every time you walk through this door. Why don't you just call me on the phone? And I would see whoever comes through our door. My office was on the highway. People would come in for bizarre reasons. I saw everything known to man. The issue then I have is, oh, if I needed to get them to a specialist. That's where the pushback was. Because the specialist is saying, well, I can't afford to see them. I'm already busy. I don't get paid. It costs me money to see them. You know, I beg them to take these patients. And they could if they had the time. And so what we're trying to do is increase healthcare rates across the spectrum for providers. But that bill was to say, listen, these hospitals, they don't have enough other patients, insurance patients, to offset the cost of those patients who don't pay them. And that's the difference in the rural areas. And so having that bill passed for critical access hospitals might be the difference with keeping the doors open.
You just heard from Senate Minority Leader Robin Titus and Senate Majority Leader Nicole Cannizzaro. I'm Lucia Starbuck, and you're listening to Purple Politics Nevada. Today's show marks the first episode of Season 3. Woohoo! And I know you're just as excited about it as I am. As we gear up for the legislative session next month, I sat down with lawmakers to learn how they're trying to improve our lives. In Nevada, the median rent is $1,600, which is higher than the national average, according to Business Insider. And the state has never successfully enacted a cap on rent increases. Democratic Freshman Assembly Member Erica Roth of Reno has made housing one of her top priorities. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Assembly Member Roth.
Thank you so much for having me.
On the campaign trail, you said housing affordability is one of your number one goals, specifically mentioning rent stability for seniors. How do you want to tackle this and why focus on seniors first?
Housing remains the most pressing issue, not just in the state, but across the country. Over 70% of my district are renters. And a lot of my district also is seniors and veterans. Last year, the Assembly Democratic Caucus put forward a bill to cap rents for seniors and veterans. And that bill was vetoed by the governor. I'm proud that my caucus will be bringing back that legislation, and I will be proud to support that. As a freshman, I'm really trying to tackle the parts that I know I can. One of those things is that as a former legal aid attorney who used to assist renters through the eviction process, is really making sure that we have robust protections when someone is being evicted. For so many people, we are one emergency away from being homeless. And when you are living paycheck to paycheck, you do not have the ability to save up money to have an emergency fund. And so ensuring that people who are struggling and are facing these evictions have the protections that are necessary is really important to me. So I'm proud to move legislation that's going to ensure if you do prevail in an eviction proceeding, that that proceeding will be sealed so it doesn't have long-term consequences. There's so many barriers that people are facing right now, and this is one of them, but the cost of rent, the ability to maintain stable jobs and union protections is another part of that. And then we have some of the lowest renter protections in the country. And of course, this isn't about allowing people to do whatever they want with their landlord's home, but it's important to recognize that people are really struggling right now. When we have people and keep people housed, it makes our communities safer. A lot of people want to talk about the homeless crisis in which we are currently in. And part of solving that is making sure that people can stay in their homes.
Last session, you were pretty active as a lobbyist for the Washoe County Public Defender's Office. You spoke in support of what was called the Homeless Bill of Rights, which would ensure people experiencing homelessness have rights just like anyone else, like the right to privacy. It didn't even get a vote. Is that something you would like to see return or even introduce yourself?
So I think that there are portions of that bill that have been in a way integrated into some of the legislation that I'm bringing. I'm really focused right now on practical solutions that I know make a difference in this community. When I talk about addressing the issue of housing, housing affordability, protecting those who are experiencing homelessness, we can't talk about all of that without talking about mental health. Through my role as a public defender, I'm very intimately familiar with how often people who are experiencing homelessness or are living paycheck to paycheck on the verge of homelessness are caught up in the criminal justice system and how that is not a solution. One of my bill priorities this session is addressing our long-term issues with our forensic psychiatric hospitals. And this is a little bit of a wonky topic. It's a very common scenario. We can see somebody who is in the middle of a mental health crisis. Let's say they're in downtown Reno, and they find their way to an interaction with a police officer, and eventually they're arrested. They meet with their public defender for the first time, and the public defender understands that they don't meet that legal threshold of being prosecuted as set forth by the Supreme Court. Now, right now, state law requires that they be transported to a state-run forensic psychiatric facility for a period of 6 months to be treated to competency. We have a decades-long problem in this state of sometimes cases being dismissed, sometimes clients' constitutional rights being abridged because the wait times to be transported are just too long because we just don't have the bed space to treat people. And it's very important to me that we intervene at a time when somebody needs help, that we give them help instead of throwing them away.
One of the things you mentioned on the campaign trail is tackling crisis pregnancy centers, which pose as legitimate healthcare facilities. They're often unregulated, non-medical, and steer patients in the direction of not getting abortions, for example. Is that something that you'd like to tackle during the legislative session, and what are your goals there?
This legislative session, I prioritized as far as women's healthcare two bills. One of them is to increase access to certain procedures. Right now, if you have an IUD placed, that is covered by insurance, but the removal is not. It's really important that when we talk about women's healthcare, it's not always abortion, right? It's about making sure that people have access to all reproductive health care, and that includes birth control. And going into a Trump presidency, it is important that we protect those who provide this life-saving health care by allowing them to make their addresses hidden. Right now, that is not possible. You know, we hear stories across the state of people who are threatened, doxed, their home addresses are released. And so in this climate, it was really important to me that they're protected as well.
You mentioned Trump's presidency. He's going to be sworn in on Monday. What other ways are you preparing for his administration?
It's hard to prepare because he's so erratic. He's made certain promises on the campaign trail that I certainly hope that he does not follow through with. One thing that we are trying to prepare for is the rising costs that we know are coming with his promise for imposing tariffs. Our caucus is steadfast in continuing our commitment to lowering costs for Nevadans, and that includes attacking the housing crisis, ensuring that individuals have access to affordable healthcare and affordable prescription drug costs.
So how difficult is it to become a homeowner in Nevada? The median price for a home is more than $462,000, according to Redfin, which also stated that Las Vegas saw one of the biggest increases in the country in investor home purchases. What can the legislature do? Can it do anything? I spoke to Democratic Senator Dina Neal about her returning bill to address this issue. Thank you so much for joining me, Senator Neal.
You're welcome.
You've already outlined some of your legislative priorities, including taking on corporate landlords. How do you define a corporate landlord, and what are some of the biggest issues they cause?
Currently, we're defining corporate landlord as, you know, a hedge fund investor where there's some international players. I really relied on the Secretary of State Securities Division. They actually go after and look for these out-of-state investors. And so I've been working on this since 2022, so before it was vetoed in 23. But why I think this is significant and why I think we need to limit the activity of corporate investors is because, you know, when families talk about home ownership, they are competing against a corporate investor. Our citizens don't have enough money to compete against a cash investor that can outbid them in the home market. There are studies that say that because of the corporate investor activity, that's also triggering the increase in the home affordability.
How will your bill address this issue?
First, it requires registration of the corporate investor. So they have to register with the Secretary of State. They also have to, when they purchase a home, the deed currently doesn't require you to list that it's an investor. So I'm changing the deed so that they have to mark the box, I'm an investor. Between the Secretary of State and the recorder's office, they have to exchange that information so that we know who the investor is, who the subsidiaries are of that investor, because one thing we know, they change names. I cap how much they can buy. So it's 100. There were questions, okay, how can you do this? Well, legislature has policing power. So policing powers can be triggered when there is a crisis for its own citizens. Currently, we're in a housing crisis. We've been in a housing crisis. Until that housing crisis is mitigated, the activity can be limited of a corporate investor in order to protect your citizens. So that's what I'm basing the public policy on. What we found out, that Redfin study that was put out in August, corporate investors own 15% of the market. They own 1 out of 4 homes in poor communities.
And so this is 100 units or 100, again, single family homes?
It's 100 single family homes over a year. And then it doesn't take into new construction, where new construction is being built actually for the purpose of selling it to families, not selling it to rent.
Looking at Governor Lombardo's veto message, he said that this would decrease interest and investment in Nevada. It would decrease blue-collar construction jobs. I see you shaking your head. How do you respond to that?
I respectfully disagree, because I want homes to be built. I want homes to be built with the opportunity for Nevada citizens to purchase them. So you have a corporate investor who's coming up and basically swiping up the entire market. Either you are in favor of capitalism or the American dream for our families.
Let's talk about some of your environmental justice bills. you want to tackle PFAS, which are a chemical. It's heat resistant. It can be found in cookware, for example. What are you trying to do there?
You know, it is a strong chemical that's been found in the body. Basically, it's called a forever chemical. It never leaves. It never leaves the water system. It's been known to cause serious risk and serious disease. One of the major things when I found out that, you know, it was a part of cookware, like that shiny sealant that we were all like, oh my God, I can't believe this is nonstick. This is awesome. Is potentially causing cancer and causing you to physically be ill long term. I want to make sure that they mitigate this. And the EPA has actually moved on this. And I want to make sure that it's not a part of our cookware. It's not a part of our consumables. It's not a part of our food, like our food packaging. That's the one bill. And then my second bill is I'm trying to go after black plastics, basically because we've recycled plastics so much. It ends up with this harmful contaminated called BFRs in these black food containers. And they have said that when the food comes in contact with that black plastic, that chemical is actually seeping into the food and trying to figure out, okay, can we go to cardboard? Can we go to another kind of food container?
How can the state legislature remove these forever chemicals from things that people use daily?
Well, at this point, you have to have a prohibition. So you have to tell the manufacturer that you cannot produce the product with PFAS. So the bill basically has them phase out and has a sell-through date where after that date, you can no longer put that product on the shelf. Last session, they argued with me or they opposed the labeling. It's a non-PFAS, just the same we have non-GMO. And they claimed that I was violating commercial speech. I disagree. I also had the legislation that I wanted to be in multiple languages. I'm bringing it back. I was able to get it out. It was vetoed. Who knows? Second time's the charm.
How are you feeling heading into this session, knowing that last session the governor had a record amount of vetoes, some of them being your bills? How do you remain positive?
You know, I've been in the legislature for a really long time. If you take losing personal, then you'll never win. You have to be in a space where you're in this for policy and you're in this for people. What's best for Nevada? Then you have to keep throwing the bills onto the table and fighting for them.
That was Senator Dena Neal, Assemblymember Erica Roth, Senator Robin Titus, and Senator Nicole Cannizzaro. I'm Lucia Starbuck, and you're listening to Purple Politics Nevada.